user's phone has left the EU for 21 days, will delete all of its apps and data. When the EU explained that this was not going to satisfy the DMA's terms, Apple threatened to pull out of the EU. And then, once everyone had finished laughing, Apple filed more than a dozen legal objections to this order, hoping to tie this up in court for a decade the way Google and Meta did with the GDPR. Now, it's not clear whether the EU can force Apple to write code to open up the iOS platform for alternative app stores and payment methods. But there is one thing that the EU can absolutely do with 100% reliability anytime it wants. The EU can decide not to allow Apple to use the EU's courts to shut down European companies that defend European merchants, performers, makers, news outlets, game devs, and creative workers from Apple's ripoff by legalizing jailbreaks. All the EU has to do... All the EU has to do is repeal Article 6 of the Copyright Directive and in so doing strip Apple of the privilege of mobilizing the European justice system to shore up Apple's $100 billion annual tax on the world's digital economy. The EU company that figures out how to reliably break iPhones will have customers all over the world, including in the USA, where Apple doesn't just use its veto power over which apps can run on your phone to suck 30 cents out of every dollar you spend, but where Apple also uses its control over the platform to strip out apps that protect Apple's customers from Trump's fascist takeover. Back in October, Apple kicked an app called IceBlock out of the App Store. Now, this is an app that warns you if there's a snatch squad of masked ICE thugs nearby looking to grab you off the street and send you to a gulag. Apple internally classified ICE officers as a protected class and then declared that IceBlock infringed on the rights of those poor, beset ICE goons. And speaking of ICE thugs, there are plenty of qualified technologists who fled the USA this year, one step ahead of an ICE platoon looking to put them and their children in a concentration camp. These skilled hackers are now living all over the world, joined by investors who would like to back a business whose success will be determined by how awesome its products are, not by how many Trump coins they buy. Apple's margin could be their opportunity. Legalizing jailbreaking, raiding the highest margin lines of business of the most profitable companies in America, is a much better response to Trump tariffs than retaliatory tariffs. For one thing, it's a targeted response. Go after big tech's margins and you're mounting a frontal assault on the businesses whose CEOs each paid $1 million out of their own pocket to sit behind Trump on the inauguration dais. Raiding big tech's margins, it's not an attack on the American people, nor on the small American businesses that are ripped off by big tech. It is a raid on the companies that screw everyday Americans and everyone else in the world. It's a way to make everyone in the world richer at the expense of these rip-off companies. It beats the shit... Thank you. Thank you. It beats the shit out of blowing hundreds of billions of dollars building AI data centers in the hope that someday a sector that has lost nearly $1 trillion shipping defective chatbots will figure out a use for GPUs someday that doesn't start hemorrhaging money the minute they turn them on. So here's a new ally in the war on general purpose computing. Businesses and technologists who would want to make billions of dollars raiding big tech's margins, and policymakers who want their country to become the disinshittification nation, the country that doesn't merely protect its people's money and privacy by buying jailbreaks from other countries, but rather the country that makes billions of dollars selling that privacy and pocketbook-defending tech to the rest of the world. Now, that's a powerful alliance. But those are not the only allies that Trump has pushed into our camp. There is another powerful ally waiting in the wings. You remember last June when the International Criminal Court in The Hague issued an arrest warrant for the genocide heir Benjamin Netanyahu, and Trump denounced the ICC, and then the ICC lost its Outlook access, its email archives, its working files, its address books, and its calendars? Now, Microsoft says they didn't brick the ICC. They say it's just a coincidence, but when it comes to a he said, clippy said between the justices of the ICC and the convicted monopolists at Microsoft, I know who I believe. This is exactly the kind of infrastructural risk that we were warned of if we let Chinese companies like Huawei supply our critical telecoms infrastructure. Virtually every government ministry, every major corporation, every small business, every household in the world have locked themselves into a U.S.-based cloud service. The handful of U.S. big tech companies that supply the world's administrative tools are all vulnerable to pressure from the Trump administration, and that means that Trump can brick an entire nation. The attack on the ICC was an act of cyber warfare, like the Russian hackers who shut down Ukrainian power generation facilities, except that Microsoft doesn't have to hack Outlook to brick the ICC. Microsoft owns Outlook. Under the U.S. Cloud Act of 2018, the U.S. government can compel any U.S.-based company to disclose any of its users' data, including the data of foreign governments, and this is true no matter where the data is stored. Last July, Anton Carnio, the director of public and legal affairs at Microsoft France, told a French government inquiry that he, quote, couldn't guarantee that Microsoft wouldn't hand sensitive French data over to the U.S. government, even if that data was stored in a European data center. Under the Cloud Act, the U.S. government can slap gag orders on companies that it forces to cough up this data, so there'd be no way to know if this is happening or if it's already happened. It doesn't stop at administrative tools either. Do you remember back in 2022 when Putin's thugs looted millions of dollars worth of John Deere tractors from Ukraine and all those tractors showed up in Chechnya? The John Deere company pushed a kill signal over the air to those tractors and bricked them. John Deere is every bit as vulnerable to the Trump administration as Microsoft is, and they can brick most of the tractors in the world, and the tractors they can't brick are probably made by Massey Ferguson, the number two company in the ag tech cartel, also an American company, just as vulnerable to political attacks from the U.S. government. Now, none of this is news to global leaders. Even before Microsoft and Trump bricked the ICC, they were trying to figure out a path to digital sovereignty. But the Trump administration's outrageous conduct and rhetoric over the past 11 months has turned digital sovereignty from a nice-to-have to a must-have. So finally, we're starting to see some movement, like Eurostack, a really cool project to clone the functionality of U.S. big tech silos in free and open source software and build EU-based data centers to run this code on. But the Eurostack is heading for a crisis. It's great to build open, locally hosted, auditable, trustworthy services that replicate the useful features of big tech, but you also need to build the adversarial interoperability tools that allow for the mass export of millions of documents, sensitive data structures, and edit histories. We need scrapers and headless browsers to accomplish the adversarial interoperability that will guarantee ongoing connectivity to institutions still housed in U.S. data centers and U.S. clouds. Because U.S. companies are not going to facilitate the mass exodus of international customers from their products. Just think of how Apple responded to the relatively minor demand to open up the iOS App Store. And now imagine the thermonuclear, foot-dragging, tantrum-throwing, and malicious compliance that they'll come up with when faced with the departure of a plurality of businesses and governments in a 27-nation block of 500 million affluent consumers. Any serious attempt at digital sovereignty needs migration tools that work without the cooperation of American big tech companies. Otherwise, you're just building housing in East Berlin for people who live in West Berlin. It doesn't matter how great that housing is, no one's going to move into it until you tear down the wall. Step one of tearing down the wall is killing anti-circumvention law so that we can run virtual devices that can be scripted, break bootloaders to swap out firmware, and generally seize the means of computation. Thank you. So this is the third block in the disenchantification army, not just digital rights hippies like me, not just entrepreneurs and economic development wonks rubbing their hands together at the thought of transforming American trillions into European billions, but also the national security hawks, who are 100% justified in their extreme concern about their country's reliance on America's platforms that have been shown to be totally unreliable. This is how we're going to get a post-American internet, with an unstoppable coalition of activists, entrepreneurs, and NatSec hawks. This has been a long time coming. Since the post-war settlement, the world has treated the U.S. as a neutral platform, a trustworthy and stable maintainer of critical systems for global interchange, what the political scientists Henry Farrell and Abraham Newman call the underground empire. But over the past 15 years, the U.S. has systematically shattered global trust in its institutions, and that process only accelerated under Trump. Take transoceanic fiber cables. The way transoceanic fiber routes were planned, the majority of these cables make landfall in the USA, and those interconnections happen there. Now, there's a good case for this hub-and-spoke topology, especially compared to establishing direct links from every country to every country. That's an order n squared problem, and directly linking each of the Earth's 205 countries with each other would require 20,910 fiber links. But putting all the world's telecoms eggs in America's basket only works if the U.S. doesn't take advantage of its centrality. And while many people worried what the U.S. could do with the head ends of the world's global fiber runs, it wasn't until Mark Klein's 2006 revelations about the NSA's nation-scale fiber optic taps in AT&T's network and Ed Snowden's 2013 documents showing the global scale of this wiretapping that the world had to confront the undeniable reality that the U.S. could not be trusted to serve as the world's fiber hub. But it's not just fiber. The world does business in dollars. Most countries maintain dollar accounts at the Fed in New York as their major source of foreign reserves. But in 2005, American vulture capitalists bought up billions of dollars worth of Argentinian government bonds after the sovereign government of Argentina had declared bankruptcy. They convinced a judge in New York to turn over the government of Argentina's U.S. assets to them, to make good on loans that those debt collectors had never issued, but instead had bought up for pennies on the dollar. At that moment, every government in the world had to confront the reality that they could not trust the U.S. Federal Reserve with their foreign reserves. But what else were they going to use? Without a clear answer, dollar dominance continued. But then, under Biden, Putin-aligned oligarchs and Russian firms lost access to the SWIFT system for dollar clearing. Now, dollar clearing is when goods like oil are priced in dollars, so that buyers only need to find someone who will trade their currency for dollars, which they can then swap for any commodity in the world. Now, again, there's a sound, logical case for dollar clearing. It's just not practical to establish deep, liquid, pairwise trading markets for all of the world's nearly 200 currencies. It's another order n squared problem. But this only works if the dollar is a neutral platform. Once the dollar becomes an instrument of U.S. foreign policy, whether or not you agree with those policies, it's not a neutral platform anymore, and the world has to go looking for an alternative. Now, no one knows what that alternative is going to be, just as no one knows what configuration the world's fiber links are going to end up taking. There are kilometers of new fiber being stretched across the open floor, and countries are trying out some pretty improbable gambits for dollar alternatives, like Ethiopia, which just revalued its national debt in Chinese renminbi. But without a clear alternative to America's enshittified platforms, the post-American century is off to a bit of a rocky start. But there is one post-American system that's easy to imagine. The project to rip out all the cloud-connected, backdoored, untrustworthy black boxes that power our institutions, our medical implants, our vehicles, and our tractors, and replace them with collectively maintained, open, free, trustworthy, auditable code. This project is the only project that benefits from economies of scale rather than being paralyzed by the exponential crises of scale that everyone else in the post-American world are confronting. That's because any open free tool adopted by any public institution, like the Eurostack services, can be audited, localized, pen tested, debugged, and improved by institutions in every country. It's a commons. It's more like a science than a technology in that it is universal and international and collaborative. After all, we don't have dueling Western and Chinese standards for structural engineering. Rather, we have universal principles for making sure our buildings don't fall down, and we adapt them to local circumstances. We would not tolerate secrecy in the calculations used to keep our buildings upright, and we should not tolerate opacity in the software that keeps our tractors, hearing aids, ventilators, pacemakers, trains, games consoles, phones, CCTVs, door locks, and governments working. Thank you. The thing is, The thing is, software is not an asset. Software is a liability. Now, the capabilities that software delivers, automation, production, analysis, administration, those are assets. But the software itself, that is a liability. Brittle, fragile, forever breaking down as the software upstream of it, downstream of it, and adjacent to it is updated or swapped out, revealing defects and deficiencies, even in systems that have performed well for years. Shifting software to commons-based production is a way to reduce the liability that software imposes on makers and users, balancing out that liability among many players. Now, obviously, tech bosses are totally clueless when it comes to this. They really do think that software is an asset, which is why they're so fucking horny to have chatbots shit out software at superhuman speeds. This is why they think that it's good that they have a chatbot that, quote, produces 1,000 times more code than a human programmer. Producing code that isn't designed for legibility or maintainability, that is optimized rather for the speed of production, that's just incurring tech debt at scale. Now, this is a neat encapsulation of the entire AI story. The chatbot can't do your job, but an AI salesman can convince your boss to fire you and replace you with a chatbot that can't do your job. Your boss is such an easy mark for a chatbot hustler because your boss hates you. In their secret hearts, bosses understand that if they stop coming to work, the business would chug along just fine. But if the workers stop showing up, the business would ground to a halt. Bosses like to tell themselves that they're in the driver's seat, but really they fear that they are strapped in the back seat playing with a Fisher-Price steering wheel. For them, AI is a way to wire the toy steering wheel directly into the company's drivetrain. It is the realization of the fantasy of a company without workers. When I was walking the picket line in Hollywood with the striking writers, a writer told me that you prompt AI in exactly the same way a studio boss gives shitty notes to a writer's room. Make me E.T., but make it about a dog and give it a love interest and a car chase in the second act. Now, you say that to a writer's room, and they will call you a fucking idiot suit and tell you, why don't you fuck off back to your office and make a spreadsheet, you nitwit, the grown-ups are here making a movie. Meanwhile, if you give that prompt to a chatbot, it will cheerfully shit out a script exactly to your spec. Now, the fact that that script will be terrible and unusable is less important than the prospect of a working life in which no one calls you a fucking idiot suit. AI dangles the promise of a writer's room without writers, a movie without actors, a hospital without nurses, a coding shop without coders. When Mark Zuckerberg went on a podcast and announced that the average American has 3 friends but wants 15 friends and that he was going to solve this by giving us chatbots, we dunked on him as an out-of-touch billionaire Martian who doesn't understand what friendship is. But the reality is that for Zuck, your friends are a problem. Your friends' interactions with you determine how much time you spend on his platforms and thus how many revenue-generating ads he gets to show you. Your friends stubbornly refuse to organize their relationships with you to the benefit of Mark Zuckerberg's shareholders. So Mark Zuckerberg's over there in Menlo Park, furiously fantasizing about replacing your friends with chatbots because that way he can finally realize the dream of a social network with no socializing. Rich, powerful people are at root solipsists. The only way to amass billions of dollars is to inflict misery and privation on whole populations, and the only way to look yourself in the mirror after you've done that is to convince yourself that those people aren't real, that in some important sense, they don't exist. Think of Elon Musk calling everyone who disagrees with him an NPC, or those effective altruists who claimed the moral high ground by saying that they cared about 53 trillion imaginary artificial humans who will come into existence in 10,000 years at the expense of extending moral consideration to people alive today. Or think of how Donald Trump fired all the U.S. government scientists and then announced the Genesis program, declaring that the U.S. was about to begin generating annual moonshot-scale breakthroughs with chatbots. It's science without scientists. Chatbots can't do science, but from Trump's perspective, they're still better than scientists because a chatbot won't ever tell him not to stare into an eclipse, not to inject bleach. A chatbot will never tell him that trans people exist or that climate change is real. Powerful people are suckers for AI because AI fuels the fantasy of a world without people. Just a boss and a computer and no ego-shattering confrontations with people who know how to do things and tell you no. AI is a way to produce tech debt at scale, to replace skilled writers with defective spicy autocomplete and lose money at a rate not seen in living memory. Now, compare AI with the project of building a post-American internet. This is a project to reduce tech debt, to unlock America's monopoly trillions and divide them among the world's entrepreneurs, for whom they represent untold profits, and the world's technology users, for whom they represent untold savings, all the while building resiliency and digital sovereignty. Now, I imagine some of you are feeling a little cynical right now. After all, your political leaders have demonstrated decades of ineffectual, incompetent deference to the United States and an inability to act even when the need was dire. If your leaders couldn't act decisively to take on the climate emergency, what hope do we have of them taking this moment seriously? But crises precipitate change. Remember when another mad emperor, Vladimir Putin, invaded Ukraine and Europe began to experience a dire energy shortage? In 3 short years, this continent's solar uptake has skyrocketed and the EU went from being 15 years behind its energy transition to a decade ahead of schedule. Because when you're shivering in the dark, a lot of fights you didn't think were worth it suddenly become existential battles that you cannot afford to lose. Sure, no one wants to argue with a tedious neighbor who has an aesthetic tamper tantrum at the thought of solar panels hanging from their other neighbor's balcony. But when it's winter and there's no Russian gas and you're shivering in the dark, that person can take their aesthetic objection to balcony solar, fold it until it's all corners, and shove it up their ass.
Beautiful. It's raining. Toko Bia. affamo e mettere le volute di petrolio in sarei. Sono messi alto le metto intorno le maglie bagnate in dalla. Farangami non illuschi, petro i mani e si va a fumare. Conte di cuscine degli uccelli c'è due, uno so. La dilatazione dei vulcani so come Gaia Fabù. Un po' di quello regolare non ha usato il suono del tempo. Si potrebbe porre un grande problema di ordine generale. Fino a che punto la verità è vera, fino a che punto la menzogna è falsa. Fino a che punto la verità è falsa, fino a che punto la menzogna è vera. Sarebbe così utile darmi il cappello, lo metterò lo stesso. Mi piace molto questa opera, non mi meraviglierebbe se avesse successo. Successo, 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 successo.
Nachricht aus dem Herzen der Frauenrevolution. Von Women Defend Rojava.
Liebe Freundinnen, wir melden uns mit den aktuellen Themen aus Rojava, dem Herzen der Frauenrevolution. Chashema Seresaleh. Die autonome Verwaltung hat die Aussetzung der offiziellen Arbeitszeiten in all ihren Institutionen und Abteilungen am Mittwoch, den 15. April 2026, anlässlich des Feiertags Roter Mittwoch, dem jesidischen Neujahr, bekannt gegeben. Das religiöse Neujahrsfest der Jesidinnen und Jesiden, Chashema Seresaleh, erster Mittwoch im April, wird am ersten Mittwoch im April nach dem julianischen Kalender gefeiert. Im gregorianischen Kalender zwischen dem 14. und 21. April. Der Mittwoch gilt als heiliger Ruhetag und erinnert an die Vollendung der Schöpfung, weshalb auch das Fest Roter Mittwoch genannt wird. Das Fest ist dem Engel Tau Simelek gewidmet, der im Zentrum des jesidischen Glaubens steht und als Gottesvertreter auf Erden gilt. Er soll jährlich zur Erde kommen, um Segen und Glück zu bringen. Daher symbolisiert das Fest sowohl den Jahresbeginn als auch den Neubeginn des Lebens. Zu den wichtigsten Bräuchen gehören das Färben von Eiern am Vortag, die die Urperle und den Ursprung des Lebens symbolisieren, sowie das Schmücken von Hauseingängen mit Blumen und bunten Eierschalen als Zeichen für Glück. Außerdem werden rot-weiße Frühlingsarmbänder getragen, die Glück bringen sollen, wenn sie von selbst abfallen. Im Heiligtum Lalisch werden viele Lichter entzündet, wobei Frauen eine wichtige Rolle als Hüterinnen des Feuers einnehmen. Das Fest wird im Familienkreis und in der Gemeinschaft gefeiert. Auch Friedhöfe werden besucht, um den Verstorbenen zu gedenken. Mit dem Wunsch Sersala Vepirosbe beginnt ein neues gesegnetes Jahr, das gemeinsam mit Musik und Freude gefeiert wird. Zeynep Chances. Viele Menschen in Kurdistan würdigen in den letzten Tagen das Leben von Zeynep Chances, der Mutter von Sakine Chances, einer Mitbegründerin der PKK. Nach dem Tod von Zeynep Chances heben viele Organisationen ihre Bedeutung für die kurdische Bewegung und den Frauenkampf hervor. Die Rolle von Müttern im kurdischen Widerstand bedeutet großen Einsatz, Lebenshingabe und Schmerz um die Gefallenen im Kampf um die Freiheit. Die alevitischen Dachverbände FEDA und DAKB erinnerten an Zeynep Chances. Sie hat nicht nur ein Kind großgezogen, sondern einen Wert geprägt, der den Freiheitskampf eines Volkes mitgestaltet hat. Bildungssystem Nord- und Ostsyrien. Sprache macht sein. Was wir denken, können wir in einer Sprache in Lauten ausdrücken und beschreiben. Wir denken durch Worte und Bilder. Diese werden durch Sprache sowie durch Schriftsprache vermittelt. Alles, was wir hören und lesen, prägt unser Denken. Es sind die Geschichten unserer Großeltern, die Nachbarin, die der Verkäuferin auf dem Markt, aber auch die der Politik und der Medien. Diese haben eine große Relevanz für unser Bewusstsein und die Entwicklung unserer eigenen Identität, unserer Gedanken und unseres Handelns. Heute haben wir Hassana Hüseyin kennengelernt, die Sprecherin der Rechtsprechung der Lehrergewerkschaft in der Region Cizre. Sie erzählte über die Herausforderungen, mit denen das Schulsystem in Nord- und Ostsyrien seit den Verhandlungen eines Integrationsabkommens konfrontiert ist. Ein wichtiger Punkt dabei ist der Erhalt der kurdischen Sprache. Nach dem Fall des Assad-Regimes haben sich die Schulen immer weiterentwickelt und kurdische, aramäische und arabische Sprachen wurden als Unterrichtssprachen eingeführt. Die Übergangsregierung möchte nun Arabisch als einheitliche Unterrichtssprache durchsetzen. Das heißt, keine Vielfalt, sondern Assimilation und Unterdrückung. Sie erzählte, dass in den Schulen in Damaskus Frauen nur noch Mädchen und Männer nur noch Jungen unterrichten dürfen. Eine erste Umsetzung der Geschlechtertrennung wurde damit vollzogen und gewaltvolle sowie patriarchale Strukturen werden gefestigt. Des Weiteren berichtet sie von der Bedeutung der Literatur und davon, dass in den letzten Jahren die SchülerInnen ihre eigenen Bibliotheken aufgebaut haben. So können sie das Lesen sowie Geschichten über ihr Land, ihre Kultur, ihre Religion und ihre Identität kennenlernen. Die Bücher sind für alle zugänglich und können ausgeliehen werden. Diese Bibliotheken würden ebenfalls mit dem Vorhaben der Übergangsregierung geschlossen werden. Bibliothek in Schengal. In der Ortschaft Duhula bei Schengal ist eine neue Bibliothek eröffnet worden. Die Einrichtung wurde vom Verband der jesidischen Jugend ins Leben gerufen. Die Bibliothek trägt den Namen Sheikh Pir Sheko und wurde im Zentrum der Organisation eröffnet. In arabischer und kurdischer Sprache sind dort Literatur, politische Schriften sowie zahlreiche Bücher zur Geschichte, Kultur und Religion der Jesidinnen zu finden. Sie dienen der kollektiven Erinnerung. Werke von Abdullah Öcalan sowie Bücher von Seki Shengali und Sakine Chances haben ihren Platz in den Regalen gefunden. Wenn Jugendliche ihre eigenen Räume für Bildung erschaffen, ist dies ein wichtiger Schritt für den gesellschaftlichen Aufbau und für Zukunftsperspektiven, insbesondere in einer Bevölkerung, die Genozid, Vertreibung und Zerstörung erlebt hat. Gedenken Anfa-Operation. Seit 2004 wird am 14. April der Opfer der Anfa-Operation gedacht. Viele Überlebende fordern bis heute Aufklärung, Gerechtigkeit und Entschädigung. Die Anfa-Operation 1986 bis 1989 war ein vom irakischen Baath-Regime unter Saddam Hussein organisierter Genozid an der kurdischen Bevölkerung und anderen Minderheiten. In mehreren Phasen wurden etwa 182.000 Menschen getötet, Millionen vertrieben oder in Lager deportiert. Tausende Dörfer sowie Infrastruktur wurden zerstört und es kam wiederholt zum Einsatz chemischer Waffen, darunter der Giftgasangriff auf Halabja 1988. Die Gewalt folgte einem systematischen Muster. Luftangriffe, anschließende Bodenoffensiven, gezielte Tötungen von Männern sowie die Verschleppung von Frauen, Kindern und Älteren in Lager, wo viele an Hunger, Krankheiten und Misshandlungen starben. Verantwortlich war Ali Hassan al-Majid, Chemi Ali. Überlebende wurden bis 1991 in Umsiedlungslagern festgehalten. Besonders betroffen waren sogenannte Anfallfrauen, die oft ihre Familien verloren hatten und unter schwierigen sozialen Bedingungen lebten. Freilassung der Kämpferin Henan. Die YPG-Kämpferin Henan ist nach 3 Monaten Gefangenschaft im Al-Ahtan-Gefängnis in Raqqa endlich befreit worden. Zuvor war sie im Al-Ahtan-Gefängnis stationiert, einem Gefängnis, das bis zur Übernahme und den schweren Angriffen der Übergangsregierung von Kessede und YPG bewacht worden ist. Das Al-Ahtan-Gefängnis gilt als eine der am strengsten gesicherten Einrichtungen für hochrangige IS-Mitglieder in Nord- und Ostsyrien. Durch die Angriffe Anfang des Jahres konnten mehr als 2000 IS-Mitglieder aus dem Gefängnis fliehen. Nach der Übernahme durch Hitische wurden auch Kämpferinnen der Kessede dort gefangen gehalten. Henan berichtet von schwerer Folter. Neben psychischem Druck sei sie auch zeitweise körperlicher Gewalt ausgesetzt gewesen. Die Kraft, dies zu überstehen, habe sie aus der Einheit der Frauen gewonnen. Sie sagt, ich habe an die Frauen gedacht, mit denen ich zusammen gekämpft habe. Ihre Kraft hat mich aufrecht gehalten. Nach der Freilassung kehrt sie zu ihrer Familie und in die Gesellschaft zurück. Um ein demokratisches Syrien und ein würdevolles Leben für alle Menschen aufzubauen, weiß sie, was zu tun ist und sagt entschlossen, ich bin eine kurdische Frau und eine Kämpferin. Ich will die Freiheit meines Volkes. Feminizide. Wenn es um die Aufklärung von Feminiziden geht, dem Mord an Frauen aufgrund ihres Geschlechts und strukturell verankerter Gewalt, übernimmt der Staat meist wenig oder keine Verantwortung. Oft werden solche Morde heruntergespielt oder als Suizid deklariert. So auch beim Feminizid an Rojin Kabaish. Dem Menschenrechtsverein IHD in Istanbul zufolge warfen UnterstützerInnen und JuristInnen den Behörden vor, zentrale Spuren nicht konsequent verfolgt zu haben. Gleichzeitig berichteten sie von Drohungen gegen die Familie. Die juristische Vertreterin der Initiative Gerechtigkeit für Rojin Kabaysh betont, die Aufklärung dieses Falls bedeutet auch, andere ungeklärte Fälle von Gewalt gegen Frauen ans Licht zu bringen. Die UnterstützerInnen kündigten an, den Fall weiter zu begleiten und Druck für eine lückenlose Aufklärung aufrechtzuerhalten. Wichtig ist, dass der Widerstand und die Forderungen nach gesetzmäßiger Aufklärung anhalten. Viele Frauen in Europa organisieren sich gegen Feminizide im Dachverband Stopp Feminizide und gehen einen wichtigen Schritt, um geschlechtsspezifische Morde zu bekämpfen. Und damit wünschen wir revolutionäre Grüße aus Rojava.
Und so sicher, wie morgen die Sonne aufgeht, so sicher wird diese Revolution siegen. Jin, Jian, Azadi!
Thank you. Een actuele Patapou-reportage. In samenwerking met Centech ProduTeam Amsterdam Internationaal en Lutjes High Profi Tepel.